Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Parenting Aces radio show on Blog Talk Radio's UR Tennis Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and you guys are in for a real treat with today's show. I think I say that a lot, and I guess maybe it gets old, but I feel like I've had just some incredible guests on the show and have had some really enlightening conversations with them about our kids and being better tennis parents and this whole world of junior tennis in general. But today, I promise you're in for a real treat. Frank Giampaolo is my guest today, and Frank has been on the show before, but in case you haven't heard him speak before, let me tell you a little bit about him. He is an author and a tennis professional. He's been in the tennis industry for over 25 years. He's based out of Southern California, specifically Laguna Niguel. And he's a writer, a coach, he's done television interviews and obviously radio interviews as well. He founded the Tennis Parents Workshops in 1998 and since then has traveled all over the world, the U.S., Mexico, Australia, Canada, most recently Israel and New Zealand, teaching us tennis parents how to do a better job with our kids. And in 2002, he started the Mental Emotional Tennis Workshops. And so I just want to let you know that there are links to all of Frank's books on our reading material page at parentingaces.com if you just click on that reading material link at the top. And also, if you want to listen to my previous show with Frank, that is in the archives on the radio show tab. So I hope you'll take a listen if you missed it the first go around. But today's show is pre-recorded, so unfortunately, I won't be able to take callers. But if you do wind up with questions for Frank after listening to today's episode, you know you can always email me at lisa@parentingaces.com, and I'll be glad to share your questions with Frank and get the answers for you. So just without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and hit the play button and let you enjoy listening to Frank and his wisdom about how we can all be better tennis parents. Have a great week, everybody.
Blog Talk Radio.
Please welcome to the show, Frank Giampaolo. Frank, thank you so much for being with us today.
Hi, Lisa. Glad to be here.
Well, we've got a lot to talk about today, so I want to just jump right in and ask you, you've recently done a lot of writing and a lot of speaking on the parents' role in junior tennis. What made you kind of get into that realm?
Well, I've been in the business of high-performance coaching for almost 30 years, and also I'm a tennis parent. My daughter went through the whole tennis wars, and she had a nice career. She won about, I think, 10 national titles and had the U.S. Open by age 15. And I kind of realized going through that, that being a tennis parent is a very different animal than being a coach. Traveling around the world doing workshops, I'm realizing more and more that there's great tennis player education. You know, there's actually great coaching education, but nobody's out there educating the parent. And as most of us know, it's in the industry, an uneducated tennis parent can unknowingly just sabotage a whole junior player's career if they're not really well informed. So yeah, I really take it upon myself to kind of jump on this and make it kind of a mission to help tennis parents around the world.
I think it's fantastic. And for the listeners that follow us on Facebook or on Twitter, they may have noticed that I've been posting a lot of your wisdom lately and tweeting a lot of your wisdom lately as you've become more active in putting that information out there in a public forum. And so as a tennis parent, I want to tell you I appreciate it so, so much. And as someone who is trying to just kind of be a portal for information for parents, you know, I love being able to link to all your stuff. So thank you so much for what you're doing.
Well, no, you're welcome. I have a great assistant now, Missy DeWalt, who is doing all the, you know, the social media for me. So she's the one to thank, actually. So she's on there every day trying to get the word out. So thanks to her.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Missy. All right. Well, so let me ask you. You've been coaching, you said, for 25, 30 years. What is your magic formula for getting a player ready for competition?
Well, I think it's the parent's role to identify the child's personality profile, which is going to dictate his style of play anyway, his or hers. And I would love to say that tennis coaches around the world will do all these things for you, tennis parents, but they honestly will not. You're going to have to be the CEO, manager of this whole project. You're going to have to, be like human resources, hiring and firing coaches. There's a million things you're going to have to get involved in. So the first thing, though, I think, if you want to really develop a national champ, is identify your child's different game plans. Like, their A game plan is she's a hard-hitting baseliner, but if that's not working, she's going to be a counterpuncher retriever, and if that doesn't work, she's going to capture the net. And at least have two or three styles, because it's really interesting with matchup. A player can be a hard-hitting baseliner and lose to another hard-hitting baseliner 10 matches in a row, but then they develop a B plan of counterpuncher, high and heavy. Well, now that style is the number one style that drives that opponent just batty. So now all of a sudden, the same girl wins the next 10 matches in a row because she has more than one style of play under her belt. So parents, first thing I would say is organize and develop different styles of play, which means you might want to have your child play against lesser opponents on the practice court while they're developing their B or C plan. So that's the first thing. I could go a little bit deeper if you want to.
Well, let me ask you this, because a lot of us don't have the knowledge or the expertise to understand a plan B or a plan C or to help our children with that. So how can we get that information? Or, I mean, you're saying that's the parents' job. Is it not also the coach's job to help the child develop those other game plans?
Well, I think it definitely should be, and I think this is one of the reasons why the mental and the emotional aspects of the game, are so secretive right now. Most coaches around the world simply do fundamental stroke production. They rally primary strokes back and forth, and when a child loses a match, they'll come out and they'll work on the follow-through on their backhand for another week, or they'll rally cross-court to each other for another week, but they don't really put together game plans. And I'm finding this around the world, whether I'm working with ITF coaches, even Fed Cup players. I had a Fed Cup player last week I was working with, and I won't mention the country, but she doesn't have a B or C game plan. She only has one style. And she's been through the best coaches in her country, and she hasn't been exposed yet. So I guess it does boil down to tennis parent education. So
right. And so, I mean, we parents hear all the time, we've got to let our kids drive the process. We've got to let them be, the ones asking for more. But if they don't know to ask for more and we don't know to ask for more, are we just setting everybody up for failure?
Well, it's definitely a lot of extra, you know, blood, sweat, tears, and money that's wasted if you don't have a detailed plan. And for me, that's what the Tennis Parent Bible was all about, was getting the parents to have a plan, because they are going to go through a series of coaches. They're going to have, you know, a whole entourage of different coaches for different reasons. And we, as parents, we just can't expect a coach to come in and do all this. Especially nowadays, it's very interesting. In the last 10, 15 years, so many of these international players, ITF players, they come to America, they play college ball, they actually take most of the scholarship money, and then they end up staying here being teaching pros at clubs. But they're not teaching the mental and emotional aspects. They're grinders. They're hitters. They're not actually teachers. So I think it'd behoove the parents to really look for detailed teachers. So the second side of that, preparing a player for competition, is your children should have their script kind of organized and developed before they play a match. And what I mean by their script is their top seven patterns of play. This is what most touring pros do, whether they're going to play in Miami or Moscow, grass, clay, first round or the finals. They're going to start every match with their top seven patterns. And when it boils down to, like, the tipping points of a really tight match, the kid that knows their top seven patterns is going to be running something they're very successful at on that mega point. And the kids that don't are going to be just kind of reacting to the moment. And they usually come in second. So if you want to take a second for the parents, I'll list the top seven so later they can rerun the program here and they can write down with their child, they can write down their top seven and then get out there on the court and start kind of developing these, as opposed to letting their kid go and just rally back and forth for 2 hours. Let me go through just the top seven real quick. I think that'll be really, really meaningful. The first thing is, number one, what's your child's favorite serving pattern to the deuce side? For example, do they like to hit a kick serve down the tee and then inside out forehand to the open backhand? What's their best pattern? Pattern number two is the serving to the ad side. And it's kind of the same concept. Let's say they have a great kick serve out wide to the backhand, and they want to run around and do a cross-court forehand. And that's their favorite. If they had to play 1 point for $1 million and they didn't know anything about the opponent, what would be their number one pattern? Going to the third, where do they like to stand when they return serve? Do they go high and heavy and stand 10 feet back like Rafa, or are they on the baseline like Serena and matching the ball speed? What's their plan against a fast first serve? Number four is, what's the plan and position returning a lousy second serve? And organizing a plan. It's really simple, but a lot of these children of the parents that are listening today, they can go out, and every kid that was beating them 6-3, 6-4, they will now beat that same person 3-3 if they start running their patterns. So we'll kind of wind it down. So the next pattern would be favorite rally pattern. How do you get the opponent vulnerable to give you a short ball so you can go offense? And some kids do high and heavy to the backhand, get a short ball. Some juniors like short angles, roll the short angle to get the opponent vulnerable. Then they get a short ball. All right, so we're down to the last two. What's your favorite short ball option? That's number six on the pattern, top seven. What's your favorite short ball option? Some players get a short ball and want to use approach shot volley patterns. Some want to crush a groundy down the line. Some like drop shots. What's your favorite short ball option? And the last, number seven, is what's your favorite net rushing pattern? a lot of gals nowadays love high and heavy moonball approach, which is like fencing the other girl to the back fence. And then they come in for a basic swing volley winner. That's how they like to go to the net. And so I think it's kind of interesting that if we can replace going out and rallying with actually running the pattern, now your children are going to practice in the manner they're expected to perform instead of just going out there and playing catch. Because I really believe tennis is a game of keep away. It's not really a game of catch at the higher levels.
It makes so much sense. And it's so simple when you break it down like that.
Well, I think that's a sign of my experience. I'm really trying to go deeper, and just deeper than any coach that I've ever met. I'm trying to go deeper into this stuff, but then present it so simple that the kids go, God, I'm jazzed. This is kind of fun. Now I have a plan.
Right.
So that's the concept behind it.
Yeah, I love that. All right. Well, so you have a new match day preparation ebook, and we'll have a link to that up on Parenting Aces. We have a link to your Tennis Parents Bible, but we haven't added the match day preparation ebook link yet, but that'll be up this week. So in there, you talk about periodization training. We've heard this concept before. I've had fitness trainers and others on the show in the past that have mentioned periodization training. I've never really gotten deep into the concept and what it means. Can you do that?
Sure. I think it boils down to real spectacular achievement. It's preceded by really smart, spectacular preparation. And let me give an example of poor pre-match preparation. Is poor periodization. As you get close to a big tournament, like 1 week before the tournament, it's really poor pre-match preparation to change any fundamental grips or strokes. We know from experience it takes 4 to 6 weeks to reprogram a bad habit and now bring in a new motor program, 4 to 6 weeks. So a good example is I had a student this past summer, Jimmy, who was going to the Clay Court Supers. So his parents sent him to St. Louis a week early to play another Clay Court tournament to get used to clay. And 2 days before that tournament, he took a couple of lessons because the dad thought they were doing the right thing. The dad gave him some lessons with a local pro in St. Louis. The local pro changed his serve grip, and Jimmy lost first round in the St. Louis first round in the clays because the Super Nationals, because he didn't have his new grip or stroke yet, and he didn't have the old one either, so he was stuck in the middle. So that's big. And also for coaches listening, that's really important that it's not the time to change strokes. You want to get your players confident with what they have the week before the match.
That makes so much sense. I've been in that situation myself. I mean, I'm sure my kid has too, but I've been there where I've taken a lesson, you know, a couple days before a match, and the coach has changed something. I'm like, I get in my match, and I don't know what to do.
Well, yeah, you're kind of toast once they mess with that. And if you think about like a NASCAR race car driving, would they put the race car up on blocks the day before the race and tear the engine apart? You know, it's probably not the best time for that. So parents, again, it's your job to make sure that when you're hiring a coach to train your children, you have to let them know they're going to be playing a tournament next Saturday. Let's just run the top seven patterns over and over and over and get confident in our skills. Let's not be changing our game at this time. Now, of course, with periodization training, there is time. There's great times to change flawed strokes, but that's when you have, you know, 3 or 4 weeks before a tournament. So,
all right, let me ask you a question then, because you're saying that the responsibility is ours as the parent to say to the coach, you know, here's the schedule, don't be messing with my kid the week before this tournament, because we don't want to mess them up. How are coaches reacting to that? Because I frankly can't imagine saying something like that and having it go over very well. Is there
well,
a trick?
It depends on the ego of the coach for sure. If he's truly interested in the best interest of your child, he wants your child to perform well come match day. So, but if he doesn't even know the child's in a match on Saturday, it might not be something that he's doing viciously. He just sees a flawed stroke and thinks it's his job to fix that flawed stroke, which it is. It's part of his job description. But sometimes it's not so much what you're changing, but when you're changing it. So.
Okay.
But, yeah, I just got back from New Zealand. I recommend to all of those parents and coaches that the child should go to the lesson with a piece of paper with three things they want to work on today. Because, I mean, a lot of coaches, we're out there all day, every day, and sometimes we just repeat the same drills every hour because it's a little bit easier, but that might not be in the best interest of an individual, you know, playing a tournament in a week. So,
sure. At what point does it become the child's responsibility to communicate these things to his coach?
Well, I think it depends on the child's growth development schedule. I mean, I have a 9-year-old that I teach that comes out and he swears he can be my assistant pro 2-2, and he'll tell the coach right there. He's 9. But I also have a 17-year-old girl that is so immature, she drops an hour to get to the lesson. She forgets to bring her tennis shoes. So I think it depends on the kid. But, you know, a serious kid has to kind of take charge of, you know, of their training and not expect the coach to know all these things, because a lot of good coaches see 30, 40 kids a week. So I do think it's up to us. Here's a couple more examples of poor periodization training. Cramming for the event 3 days before, overdoing their off-court training 2 or 3 days before, because, you know, that leads to soreness, fatigue, and injuries on match day, and cramming for the event 3 days before leads to just drain low batteries on match day, and adding really unfamiliar things to routines a day or two before, that's not comfortable either. So that could even be like a gal wearing a new dress that she's not comfortable wearing. So that's poor periodization training, introducing a brand new stroke the week before a match. These are all...
What should be going on? What should be going on the week before the match?
Well, they should be organizing their A and B game plan, so they should be playing sets with their A plan and sets with their B plan. They should be running patterns religiously over and over and over, their top 7 patterns of play. That's really important. And the drills that coaches work on, we should be incorporating negative scoring, which means, let's say you have an exercise that you're going to get to 10, hit 10 balls cross-court deep, but every time the player misses a shot, it's -1 to the score. But now that the player has to actually stay focused and finish the game to 10, because what most kids do, they get to 7, then they go back down to 4, then they get up to 9, they go back down to 5. And this actually helps build the emotional muscle needed to close out games and close out matches. But that's a great little secret right there, is to add negative scoring. Let's say one of your parents is out serving buckets of balls, don't just serve buckets for a half hour. Serve buckets of balls, divide the service box into half, and so you got to hit kick serves wide, and you got to get to 10. But every time you miss a serve, it's -1, and we're going to go until you get to 10. So now you'll see the negative scoring. It drives people batty. It's like simulated stress. And I think that is really a great tool right before a match. You want your children to be comfortable being uncomfortable. You get it?
I totally get that. I love that. And Carlos Goffey talked about a similar type of drill pattern when he was on the show a few months ago. So I think you smart, experienced coaches, you're onto something here. And I think we need to start incorporating more of that because, we've all seen our kids be up 5-2, you know, and choke the set, or be up 5-0 and choke the set. I mean, it happens. And so having them practice stressful situations, it makes so much sense to me.
And that's kind of just multitasking, really, which is, it's not even that hard for young kids today because, I mean, you see them, they're doing their homework, they're doing YouTube, they're texting somebody, they're Instagramming somebody else. But they're used to multitasking, so I think it's okay for us to work on stroke mechanics, moving, emotional control, all in the same drill.
Right, for sure. All right, well, let's move on. You have a chapter in the new book on opponent profiling. Can you talk a little bit about that? What does it mean, and how do our kids use that to their advantage?
Yeah, sure. To me, opponent profiling is a deeper way of paying attention. So almost always if I'm sitting with a junior player and their parent, if we're scouting the next opponent, I would ask them, well, what are you looking for? And they would say, well, I want to know if their forehand's better than their backhand and how fast they serve and, you know, do they go to the net? And that's about it. But I like the idea with opponent profiling to go a little bit deeper because I think it's another one of those key issues that will tip those close matches in your favor if you're doing, you know, profiling, not just before a match, but even more so during a match. So to me, opponent profiling is, first of all, you know, spot the opponent's primary style of play. So, and parents, when you get to a tournament site, ask your child to look down the row of courts and categorize every player every time you get to a site. So your daughter would say, that's a hard-hitting baseliner. That's a hard-hitting baseliner. Over there is a moonball pusher. There's another moonball pusher. That looks like more of a drop shot artist. There's another hard-hitting baseliner. She's getting used to spotting the style of play. The second thing with opponent profiling is a little bit deeper, which is part of the mental side, but it's identifying the opponent's top seven patterns of play. Because guess what? If they're smart and they're national champions, guess what they're going to be doing on big points? They're going to be running their favorite patterns on big points. I had a couple players with me as a short story at Indian Wells, and Rafa Nadal was playing a match, and we were charting and serving out wide on the ad side. Rafa served 92% slice serve out wide, run around, inside out, forehand, ahee, for the next shot. 92%. So
yeah.
Rafa knows his go-to pattern, and Rafa's smart enough to play his go-to pattern because here's the bottom line, really, with patterns. If it wins 2 out of 3 points, you will win the match easy. You don't need to change because maybe they might figure it out, which is how a lot of juniors overthink. So if you kind of look at just a graph, a bar graph, if you're at the bottom and you're at 0, if you win a point, lose a point, win a point, now you're at 1. Win a point, lose a point, win a point, you're at 2. Win a point, lose a point, win a point, now you're at 3. You will win the match if you just stick to your patterns. As long as you're winning 2 out of 3, it's an easy match. So,
yeah.
And with profiling, that's a big key. You don't just know your own top seven, but by the end of the first set, you kind of know theirs. You go, well, when I give this dude a short ball, he crushes it up the line. So I'm going to start to slide over and read that. So then there's basic things besides the top pattern. Top patterns is strokes, strengths and weaknesses, movement, agility, stamina. You're paying attention to the opponent's stamina and their movement and their agility and their frustration tolerance. So Yeah, opponent profiling is pretty big, and it's interesting for me, but at the higher levels, they're all good athletes, and they're smart. And the calls that I get every week from tennis parents is, my child's the best athlete, but they always lose to these toads, and I don't know why they lose. But it's real funny because they've never developed these mental or emotional skills.
Right.
So that's opponent profiling a little bit.
And it sounds so simple. I mean, when you break it down, it makes total sense. And we've seen this over and over again where, you know, once you reach a certain level in the game, everybody hits the ball well, everybody's fit, everybody moves well, but yet there is a core group that is consistently winning matches, winning tournaments. And it's got to come down to these details that you're discussing, having these patterns, understanding the opponent and their patterns. I mean, to me, it just makes perfect sense. But yet our kids oftentimes aren't taught these things by their tennis coaches.
Well, no, I agree. I agree for sure, and I think that's our job. That's our job as tennis coaches, to go a little bit deeper than just fundamental stroke production, and let's start to dig into the art of winning, because, you know, other countries are really kind of kicking our butts out there at the higher levels, and they're just training smarter. So
I'm going to come back to that whole idea of the art of winning. I want to come back to that in a few minutes because it's a touchy subject, and I want to get your thoughts on something. But before we go there, I want to just keep going because I have some questions for you. One of the things you recommend is warming up the complete tool belt of primary and secondary strokes on game day, mm-hmm. instead of what we see typically happening in the warm-up. Can you explain what that means and the rationale behind it?
Yeah, sure. We all know the typical warm-up is rally some low hard ground strokes back and forth to each other, go to the net, volley right back to the opponent. When your opponent asks for a lob, you lob a short, low lob right to him. And what you're doing really is you're warming up the exact strokes you don't want to use in a match. So it's pretty funny for me when I see it. So what I like to have the players do, especially the younger players, is to warm up primary and secondary. So I'll use like a painter's analogy. If we all wanted to go out and experience this whole painting hobby, we would buy a paint set. It would come with a primary strip of paint, and that would have a black, a brown, a green, you know, just primaries only. And we would paint primary paint. We'd paint our paintings, and our paintings would always look it's a little immature, a little bit average. Our paintings would never be lifelike and real. But the really good painters, they know a secret. Well, they develop secondary colors too. They don't have one green on their palette. They have 12 greens. And now their paintings are lifelike, and they can make money with painting. And so, parents, one of the things I recommend is really develop and build the full tool set, not just primary stroke. So from today forward, your child doesn't have one forehand. They have five. They have the hard drive, which most kids hit all day, every day. They have high and heavies. You know, heavy and high makes them cry kind of thing. They have the short angle topspin to pull retrievers off the court. They have slice, and they have defensive high lobs. Those are five different kinds of forehands, primary and secondaries. Five different backhands. We have to develop five different backhands, same thing. Drive, high and heavy, slice, short angles, and, of course, a defensive lob. And having a tool belt of serves, kick, flat, slice. Tool belt of volleys. They have swing volleys, drive volleys, drop volleys, half volleys. There's even a full tool belt of different kinds of approach shots. Now, it's just the idea, again, about going a little bit deeper. But to use the analogy of golf, Tiger Woods, he warms up every club in his bag before every round in case he needs it. but most juniors don't. So let's see, you know, how would this play out in a match? Let's kind of play through it a little bit. We're now into a tiebreaker in the first set. All right, your child creams a great cross-court ball. The opponent runs and throws up a moon ball. The player that has already warmed up all of their swing volleys moves in five steps, knocks off the swing volley, wins the breaker, takes the match. The other kid that only rallied the old-fashioned way now gets the same crushing ground stroke. The opponent hits the same moon ball. Now they take one step in and stop, and they hesitate. They go, wait, I don't remember the last time I hit one of these. And then they shake it and lose the breaker. They get all mad, lose the match. So I think that's big, primary and secondary. Warm up all the tools in your tool belt.
Let me interrupt you one second. This warm-up is
sure.
happening. This is not the 10 minutes or 5 minutes that they get right before their match. You're talking about the warm-up that they're doing prior to being called to play for their match, so maybe an hour before the match or whatever. And they're doing this warm-up either with us, their parent, which not in my case because I could never do that with my kid, or they're doing it with their coach, or maybe they're doing it with one of their buddies. Is that right?
That's correct. And that's one of the, you know, deeper ways of warming up. And we all read the Rafa books and the different autobiographies. And, yeah, a lot of the top players, they're throughout their 45 minutes warming up all their tools. And, you know, that little five-minute warm-up before the match, that's just to kind of loosen up your shoulders a little bit and maybe pay attention to the opponent for a few minutes. But, yeah, you've got to be fully warmed up before you even get into the parking lot. And so, if you're not doing that, then here's the ugly truth is you're a hobbyist and so is your kid. But that's fine, too. And tennis is one of the best hobbies in the world. But I think it's important that we say that if it is just a hobby, that's fine. Don't worry about all this stuff and just enjoy high school ball and have fun with it. And it should be fun. But if you want to take it serious, if you want to kind of develop a national champion, that's kind of a different animal. And so you can't be a hobbyist, and neither can your kid, if you want to have national titles under your belt. So.
Right, right.
It's harsh, isn't it? It's mean, but it's like, it's true. So.
Well, it's interesting because I recently did a piece on defining success, and I talk about that. You know, one of the great things about tennis is there are so many different levels at which a kid can play. They can play for fun.
Yeah.
They can play, you know, sort of competitively, or they can go full in and you know, strive for these national titles and strive for the top level college teams and strive to be a professional. And I think it is really important for the player, the parent, and the coach to be on the same page with that and to understand what the goals are, because if you don't train for those goals, then you're setting yourself up for failure.
Yes. And I agree 100%. And that's what I'm trying to say. I guess that same concept. I'm going to have to go back and find that article of yours. I think that's right on the money.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to shift gears a bit because I would like to get you into talking about the actual day of the match and what the parent's role is. We've talked about preparing for the tournament, but now let's get to the day of. And I had a dad post a question on the Parenting Aces Facebook page that I want to just read to you and get you to talk about a little bit. He says, what should you discuss with your child on the drive to a tournament? My daughter, age 11, can sometimes look at the draw and be more focused on the parent of the child that she's going to play and not the player. And maybe that's because the parent has a bad reputation for coaching or clapping inappropriately or whatever. And then the child ends up in tears before the match even starts. So this dad says he tells his daughter to concentrate only on what she can control. But is it better to keep it simple and say the basics, such as enjoy the match, try your best, or should you say more? How can we help our kids here?
Well, that's a great question. Thanks to the dad for posting that. From my side of the coin, it's all about de-stressing your child and only focusing on the performance. So performance-oriented issues and comments versus adding stress, and that comes from outcome-oriented communication. So then let's go through a couple of examples of it. We have a ton of fun in our tennis parent workshops with this topic because most children and parents that are there, they just die laughing because their parents are all guilty. But so I'll go through a couple of the things real quick. So it is important to de-stress, talk about the performance of, you know, preparing your equipment, nutrition and hydration. You know, a lot of girls say, I'm too nervous, I'm not going to eat before the match. So that's appropriate, right, for a parent to talk about that. Inappropriate communication would be a parent saying things like, you're playing the number two seed, you got to really be on your A game today. Outcome-oriented right there. And
and we've all been guilty of that.
And we all are. That's the funny part, because you can't help yourself. We get so involved. It's a riot, but... So, yeah, you can go deeper, though. For sure, parents can talk about applying the proper warm-up routines, you know, like primary, secondary, as opposed to explaining why, you know, today's match is the most important match of your career. That's, you know, outcome-oriented, and that's a great way to stress out your kid. So you can go deeper, too, parents, with discuss your players and even the opponent's A and possible B game plans. Like, we noticed this gal is a hard-hitting baseliner you're going to play, and she likes to go to moonball push when she's stressed out and in trouble. That's her B plan. Man, that's smart. That's smart parenting right there. Describing the consequences if you lose, though, like, you know, you're going to be demoted to high school doubles if you lose this match. You're not going to get that scholarship. Your USTA ranking is going to drop if you don't win, or it's going to go to this level if you do win, and now you're going to get invited to the high-performance group. And these are all just silly, outcome-oriented issues that just only add stress and sabotage any chance that, you know, your child is going to have a peak performance day. But the funny thing is the list just goes, you know, it goes on and on. But as long as the parents are talking about performance-oriented issues, then I think it's okay to look at the draw. If you look at the draw and say, we're going to be in a match coming up, and the child and the parent are talking about, we're playing a hard-hitting baseliner, here's the top seven patterns, here's our performance goal that we're going to try to shoot for, that's fine. But if looking at the draw means you're going to be pulled into outcome-oriented communication, you know, like, okay, I looked up the draw, I looked up this person for you, honey, and, well, here's a list of all the good players she's already beaten, and this is going to be a huge win for us. If you don't blow it today, it's going to be a big win. You know, that kind of thing is silly, but I've even had a parent say, reminding the kid on the drive, look, we spent $2,000 getting to this tournament. If you don't perform up to your level, we're not doing this anymore. And of course, the kid couldn't even, you know, walk without tripping after that. So she was doomed, and she blew that match easy. But sometimes parents have to be educated, you know?
Right.
So.
Well, and this dad says something, you know, one of the basics, like, enjoy the match. I'll tell you, you know, my kid looks at me when I tell him to have fun out there. He's 17 now. He looks at me like I'm nuts. You know, this isn't about having fun. This is about going out there and kicking some butt, Mom. You know, I'm going out there to win. And so I struggle with that because from my perspective, you know, if a 17-year-old kid isn't having fun out there, what's the point? You know,
you're right on. I think you're right on. My mentor teaching all you know, all this stuff was Vic Braden, and I started my career at his tennis college as a coach, but his slogan was laugh and win. And when you're laughing and you're having fun, you're de-stressing. And you know, like your son, like most kids, when they only want to win, they're totally outcome-oriented. They're in the wrong side of their brain compared to every tennis champion on the planet. Tennis champions are performance-oriented, not outcome. And when you're just kind of, when you're laughing and winning and having fun like you're talking about, I mean, we watch Grand Slams, and you look at Djokovic, and these players are smiling. Nadal is smiling. They're intense. They're serious. They want to win, but they're enjoying the moment too, and I think you can do both. So
Right. When your kid's 8, 9, 10, it's very different from when your kid's 14, 15, 16, 17. You know, the communication is very different. Maybe you can shed some light on how we as parents need to adjust as our kids get older.
Well, I do think we need to let them begin to make their own decisions, which you mentioned that earlier. That's really important. We'll need to start, from my side, when I teach a player that's 14 or above, I don't ever really tell them what to do. I ask them, what do you think you should have done there? Or what do you think you should do in this situation? And I begin to let them kind of drive the whole program. Even though I'm the coach and they're the student, I want them to feel like it's their idea. And if they throw out a silly bad idea, I'll try to reroute to get a better answer out of them. But to me, that kind of even begins with the idea of having your child be the co-pilot, have them be in charge of finding a warm-up partner, finding warm-up sites, finding the tournament, finding the restaurant, finding the hotel. And the more they're in charge of these things, the more they get used to problem solving. Mm-hmm. And now on the court, they are a little bit better. They're a little more rehearsed at problem solving. But I agree. When you're dealing with a 16, 17, 18-year-old, probably like all of us, it's amazing how brilliant we were back then because we thought we knew it all, you know?
Right. Well, it's interesting. My kid at 17 has, in the past year, taken himself to a few tournaments that have been within a couple hours driving distance. And I've noticed a big change in his attitude as he's getting ready to leave. When I travel with him, there's a lot of stress, you know, and do you remember to pack this? Did you get that? You know, oh, Mom, you didn't wash my blah, 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 blah. You know, how could you forget to wash that? What do you mean you didn't pick up a case of water? You know, we have those kinds of conversations. But
yes,
when he's taking himself in charge of driving himself, packing his car and, you know, being responsible, it's a whole different interaction. It's, you know, me saying, make sure you text me every hour so I know you're not laying dead on the side of the highway somewhere, and basically him handling everything else. And I love that. I mean, I miss, when I'm not there, I miss seeing him play, but I don't miss that stress of match preparation and tournament preparation. And I'm wondering if you have any advice to kind of alleviate some of that or try to create that same kind of environment as when he goes by himself.
Well, I'm not too keen on sending him by himself either, right? But if he could go with a coach that could chart or videotape the match, I like that idea a little bit better. If you look at the top pros in the world, they don't even go by themselves. They have, you know, coaches, parents. I mean, I have videotaped when I was coaching at the Australian Open of, I'm standing right behind, 5 feet away of Djokovic on the practice court with his dad and his coach and his physio trainer, and they're all talking about his movement and his agility and his patterns. And even people at that level, they need an entourage. So I don't know if going by himself is just kind of buying. Is he getting great results? What's his results like? Are they any different, positive or negative?
Well, hard to tell because he's coming off an injury, so this has all been kind of recent. So I'm not sure I can gauge that fairly, but when I say he's by himself, I mean he's going and staying at a friend's house who's also playing in the tournament, or, you know, staying at a hotel with a friend. He's not completely alone, but definitely not a coach keeping an eye on him or, you know, somebody managing every moment of his day like there is when I'm with him or when a coach travels with him.
Yeah. Well, I've yet to see anybody be crazy successful with that formula of going by yourself, because there's so many things that can cause stress that even just him being alone and checking into a hotel and finding gas stations and finding the site and getting practice balls, and the list goes on and on, but all of the hundreds of things that you do for him, if he's doing it by himself, he's going to be one tired dude before he even steps on the court to play. And there's so much mental and emotional stress that goes with it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I think my mindset behind that is, you know, I want him to be independent and learn and understand what it means to manage these things alone. Because when you look at the young pros on the tour, and I've had an opportunity to talk to a couple of the young players, I'm sure you've talked to gobs of them, you know, when they're first starting out, they may not have the luxury of being able to travel with a coach or travel with a parent or a girlfriend or boyfriend. You know, they may be out there on their own. And, you know, I think it's important for them to understand and to know that they can manage those things by themselves, that they have the strength within themselves to step up and do it when it's necessary.
Yeah. Well, that's a great example of life lessons that you're implementing that right there. And probably when we look at another year or so down the road, when your son or any other 17-year-old goes to college, all these life skills of time management, organization, you know, perseverance, work ethic, all these things that you're building right now, he's going to be the kind of kid that thrives in college, as opposed to the type of, you know, tennis phenom that their parents do everything for them, and now they do finally go to college, and now they don't even know how to, you know, find their shoes. So I like that for the life lesson side. That's neat.
We'll see. We'll see how it all works out. So far, it's been okay.
Keep me posted. I'm interested.
Yeah, I definitely will. All right, I got one more question, and then we're going to talk a little bit about this whole idea of winning and losing. But one of the things you recommend is charting matches, and you have some really detailed information on the best ways to chart matches, and also video analysis. Why are those things so important in your mind?
Well, for the parent side, it's a great way to channel their nervous energy into something, you know, proactive and productive. So we know that, you know, communication, most of it is nonverbal. So a parent sitting with their arms crossed tight, stressing and fussing, kids see that, and they see the nervousness. They see the nervous energy, and that does add stress to the player. So giving the parent something to do that's really going to help the coach in the next week, that's meaningful. The charting and videotaping is really just paying attention to, you know, all these flexible skill sets that a child is using in a real match. So if we use a video analysis for an example, a lot of coaches and a lot of players, they set up a video camera in a practice session, maybe even behind the player, they videotape a stroke, and then they do the analysis of stroke production. And that's great, but that's not really flexible skills. That's a consistent skill, the same shot over and over. But the art of winning is kind of found in match play. And so if you videotape a match, then I really recommend paying a smart coach to watch the match with your child. Because this coach is going to spot 100 things that your child doesn't even know exist in a match. Like, for example, when we do video analysis, we sit down after a match, and we talk about, strengths and weaknesses and stroke production. Are you implementing strategies and tactics at the appropriate time? So are you running your top 7 patterns on a mega point, or are you doing a high-risk ace bomb down the tee that only goes in once every other November, or are you doing the kick serve out wide like you're supposed to? But you can spot these things, the actual cause of the error. Sometimes errors are caused by bad stroke production. But at higher levels, it's reckless shot selection, bad movement and spacing. Well, if you're videotaping a real match and you see that the number one cause of errors is poor movement and spacing to the ball, going back the next week and having the pro feed balls right to your kid and hitting strokes, it's not going to help because the movement and spacing to the ball was the cause of the error. So you can pay attention. You can really spot a lot of neat little secondary things, which will tip the match in your kid's favor the next time they play. So we talk a lot about dissecting the opponent. Remember opponent awareness. A great example, I was watching one of my past students, Sam Curry, play a match at Indian Wells, and I can't remember the name of the opponent. The opponent, a couple of years back now, probably 3 or 4 years, the opponent hit a kick serve wide on the ad, won the point, kick serve wide, won the point, kick serve wide, won the point. And I'm sitting with a couple other students, and even a younger kid said, why doesn't he slide over and shut down that serve? And so we're talking about this idea about opponent awareness, pay attention to the opponent's top 7. See, these are all learned behaviors in the art of winning. And it comes from your child sitting down and watching himself or herself play an actual match. Even things like emotional control. A couple of weeks ago, I had a player that said, I don't really get emotional anymore. I'm getting a lot better. And then we watch one of her videos of a match, and she's smacking her racket, cursing and stomping around. I think it was like 18 times in that match we counted. And her perception was she doesn't even do it anymore. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's interesting that sometimes they walk off the court as a kid, and they have a whole different take on the match than you did as a parent sitting there watching.
Right, and I think, developing that self-awareness is a process, too. I mean, I've had similar conversations with my kid, and, I'll ask him after a match that appeared to me as if he was playing in a nervous state. And so, after he's calmed down, not right after, but, later, I'll say, were you feeling nervous out there? Because you looked like you were playing nervous tennis. And he'll say, no, I wasn't nervous, what I was seeing and what he was perceiving that he was feeling were very different. And who's to say who was right or wrong, but I do feel like it's a process for them to learn to tune in and recognize those things.
Yeah, it sure is. And we talk a lot about visual learners and a kid sitting down watching the match, that's proof. That's proof of what really is going on. And instead of just having opinions after the match, now there's actual documented proof of what's going on in the match, and it's amazing to me how off they can be sometimes.